Ladies and gentlemen, may I welcome all of you to this very happy occasion in honor of a great American. One of the ironclad rules of the Commonwealth Club of California is that at its luncheon meetings, there is no introduction of anyone but the speaker. Through the 54 years of its existence, the club members have persisted in the belief that our invited speaker's allotted time should not be pared down by introductions. But since this is an evening meeting and the occasion is more than usually a festive one, we will depart slightly from normal procedure and take pleasure in presenting the first citizen of San Francisco, who is here to join with us in welcoming the Vice President of the United States, Mayor George Christopher. Good to see you, George. And I would say to you, to the members of the club, and to our friends that through the years, Mayor Christopher has consistently been of great help to our luncheon program committee in the scheduling of some of our major events, and we are proud to have him seated with our club officers at the head table tonight. We also take pleasure in having with us, and I would present to you, Mrs. Christopher Tulip. When I visited Dick Nixon in Washington on the 1st of May and renewed in person the invitation that our luncheon program committee had already extended to him, he promised that he would speak to us at the very first opportunity. And he told me then that when he did meet with us, he would prefer to follow the club's usual procedure, under which the informality and the directness of our question and answer period is an important feature of Commonwealth Club meetings. We have complied with his wish, and you will find cards on your tables upon which you may write out your questions. When you have done so, please hand them to the club staff members who will circulate among the tables and collect them very shortly. I would call your attention to the fact that the printed statement on this card that they will be collected at about 1:10 has no reference to this meeting. For those in the audience who are already friends of Dick Nixon and to those who want to be, I would announce that immediately following the portion of the meeting in this room, he has graciously agreed to step into the adjoining Rose Room in the back here, where for a reasonable period of time there will be a reception where you may meet him personally. Tonight, Vice President Nixon has exceeded even his own promise for this occasion. For the only assurance that he gave us was that he would be here. When the committee learned that Mrs. Nixon would also be present, it was immediately decided that this dinner would have to be a ladies' evening, so that our ladies might have an opportunity to be present with her and to greet her. In behalf of all of the members of the Commonwealth Club, their ladies and guests, we are pleased to acknowledge the presence among us of this very charming and gracious lady, the wife of the Vice President of the United States, Pat Nixon. Since her bonanza days, San Francisco has always cherished an occasion when America's foremost statesmen or military heroes could be among us and be welcomed as her guests. One of the first occasions of this nature occurred on September 3, 1865, when Schuyler Colfax, the Speaker of the House of Representatives under Abraham Lincoln's administration, was tendered a farewell dinner by the leading citizens of San Francisco. Incidentally, Schuyler Colfax later served as Vice President of the United States in the Grant administration. Speaker Colfax, many of you will recall, was the last man who conferred with Abraham Lincoln on official business. And as they parted at the doorway of the White House on the evening of April 14, 1865, President Lincoln's last words to Colfax were, "I will telegraph you at San Francisco, goodbye." Colfax made the overland journey to the Pacific to inform himself of the actual condition and the needs of the Western Territories and the Pacific Coast. He traveled by stagecoach from Atchison, Kansas, and that portion of the trip took 10 days. By way of contrast, our guest of the evening left Washington this morning at 7 o'clock. He flew to Newark, New Jersey, and then proceeded by helicopter to the Battery in the lower end of Manhattan Island. There, in the company of Mayor Robert Wagner of New York City, Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York State, and Governor Robert Minor of New Jersey, he reviewed the fleet in commemoration of the 350th anniversary of Henrik Hudson's trip up the Hudson River. Next, he flew by helicopter to Idlewild International Airport on Long Island, where he took off by jet-propelled plane at about 1:45 in the afternoon. That's by Eastern Daylight Time. Because the plane was a late taking off by about an hour, he arrived at the San Francisco International Airport at approximately 4:25 this afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. Again, by way of contrast with Speaker Colfax, our Vice President does not have to come here to learn of the condition and the needs of the Pacific Coast, for he is one of our own, and he knows our problems intimately. Next month, he takes off for Moscow by jet airliner as an American goodwill ambassador to open the United States exhibit at the Moscow Trade Fair. And then he will travel for a week or more in other parts of Russia and Siberia. Richard Milhouse Nixon is a native son of California, having been born in Yorba Linda in Orange County on January 9, 1913. We all know well his record as a member of the House of Representatives and of the United States Senate. He is one of the three men who in the history of our country have been twice elected Vice President of the United States. Beyond the duties of the Vice President, he has become, as his coming trip to Moscow will prove again, one of the major statesmen of the world. Personally, I am very proud of the fact that Dick Nixon is one of my warm personal friends. And the entire Commonwealth Club of California is privileged to present him to you tonight as its guest and our speaker of the evening. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States. Well, Mr. President, Mr. Mayor, distinguished guests at the head table, members of the diplomatic corps, and my fellow members of the Commonwealth Club and guests of the Commonwealth Club. It's a very great honor and privilege for both me and my wife to be here and to finish for what for us has been a rather busy day, but a rather memorable one. As Gardner Johnson pointed out in his introduction, we started in Washington this morning. I should say, however, that actually we did not leave Washington at 7. We didn't leave till 10, because I had breakfast with the president at 7:45 in Washington. That did not finish until approximately 9, then over to the airport. And from that period, from 10 o'clock until 5:30 this afternoon, the events that he has described took place. And I can only say that it's with a very warm feeling of gratification that we get back to San Francisco, back to this delightful climate. 67 degrees, I noticed, was showed on the thermometer as we came driving through. And in New York today, although it wasn't as hot as yesterday when the temperature was about as hot as the New York Yankees, and that's pretty hot at the moment for you baseball fans, particularly from where we look at the cellar of the American League, where the Senators finally descended again, I understand, this morning. Nevertheless, it was warmer in New York and much warmer in Washington than it is here. And so not only because of the good company that we find here this evening, but also for the famous climate of San Francisco, we are happy to be here, if even for a very short time. I think, too, of the fact that in celebrating, as we did with the governors of New York and New Jersey and the mayor of New York City, that event 350 years ago when Henry Hudson sailed up that river, that it took him 5 months to come from the port from which he left in Europe to the time he arrived at the mouth of the Hudson. And to think that this much has happened now, and that when we get on a jet transport, a replica of the one which we traveled in today, and we'll travel to Moscow in approximately 11 to 12 hours, is an indication of progress, and also an indication of the speed with which we travel in this day and age. Now, having referred to the events which have preceded this evening, I also want to take notice of the fact that every member of this club is very much aware. The fact that before the Commonwealth Club come distinguished speakers from all walks of life and from all parts of the world. As a matter of fact, Stuart Ward has called me from time to time in view of the fact not only that I am a Californian, but a member of the club, and I have assisted him at times in obtaining speakers for the luncheon meetings. And recognizing that the quality of the speakers you have is high, it was for that reason, as a matter of fact, that I suggested to Gardner Johnson that rather than attempting to make a formal speech, that I would prefer to leave the choice as to what I should discuss tonight to you by allowing you to ask the questions rather than to have me select the subjects and to filibuster as long as I could so that the question period would be relatively small. Now, just before the meeting began, I was asked by Gardner Johnson and also by Stuart Ward how long I was going to speak. I said, "Why do you need to know?" They said, "Well, we've got to be able to tell the people, the girls, when they start picking up the questions." Well, I'm going to tell you how long I'm going to speak by giving you an illustration of some advice I received from a very, very wise source this morning. They say, you know, of course, that you always get great wisdom from the mouths of babes and youngsters. I can say that as far as my advice this morning, as we were riding up to New York in the plane, my younger daughter, Julie, who is traveling with us on this occasion, along with our other
daughter Patricia, came up to me and with the typical wide-eyed innocence of a 10-year-old said, "Daddy, how long are you going to speak at this ceremony where we get to see the fleet and then take a helicopter ride afterwards?" And I said, "About 10 minutes. And she said, "Yay." I said, "Well, why do you say that? Because I'm speaking so long a time?" She says, "No, because you're speaking so short a time." And so I believe that 10 minutes is about the right amount of time for an opening remark and an occasion when, like this, when you have the opportunity to ask the questions. And so I would simply conclude in this vein. Mention has been made of the fact that only two of my predecessors in this office were elected twice to that office. And one of them thought so little of it that he resigned in order to become a United States Senator again. I must say that sometimes you're tempted to do so. But be that as it may, I can also say that the Vice Presidency, as you know, is an office which many of our friends abroad find very difficult to understand, and some of them, of course, find it so useless that even in democracies or republics which are patterned somewhat after ours, they have even dispensed with the office altogether. I'm often asked, what is the responsibility of a vice president other than presiding over the United States Senate? And the answer is, of course, that as distinguished from members of the cabinet, who are necessarily specialists in certain fields, that the vice president of the United States is not a specialist in any field. He is one, on the other hand, however, who has access to information in all the areas of government. As I like to describe it, he really has an admirable position and situation. In that respect, he has a seat on the 50-yard line for the greatest show on earth, because he sits in the cabinet meetings, in the meetings of the National Security Council, in the meetings of the president with his legislative leaders, and while he has no power, as do some cabinet officers and all cabinet officers, and of course, as does the president, he at least does have the opportunity to know what is going on. And so, with that in mind, I suggest that your questions can cover a very broad area. A very broad area, not because I can promise to answer them all as effectively as you might want them answered, but because at least I should be expected to be able to do so. And so with that, may I suggest, Mr. Chairman, that you can turn now to the questions, and we can have them come up while I am answering the first ones that are available.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Now, here is the first one, which poses a question that I'm sure is first in the minds of the members of this club and of most Americans. Is there any hope for a unified Germany?
Well, the obvious answer to that question is, of course, yes, there is hope for a unified Germany. The more basic question is, what are the practical possibilities in view of the intransigent attitude that the leaders of the Soviet Union, and particularly Mr. Khrushchev, are taking on this issue? At the present time, as you are aware, it is the position of the governments of the Allied countries, the free countries, as well as the position of the Republic of Germany, that German unity is not only a goal toward which we should work, but that it is an objective which it is essential that we reach if we want to have a European settlement which will not carry within it the seeds of eventual dissension and war. Why do we say that? Because when you take in the heart of Europe a people as vital, as strong, as vigorous, as productive as the German people, and divide them, as long as that division exists, you will have in the future inevitable stresses and strains within those peoples on both sides of the dividing line to draw together. And you will have, therefore, the possibilities of that very division being exploited by one side or the other, or by proponents of one side or the other, exploited in such a way that it could lead to certainly disagreement at the conference table, and even something worse in, of course, disputes which would be settled on the battlefield. Consequently, we believe that only by insisting on a program which is aimed eventually at bringing about a united Germany can we be standing for a program that, in the final analysis, if it is consummated, will result in a peaceful Europe. Now, as far as the possibilities are concerned, however, they appear very dim at the present time. Dim because Mr. Khrushchev, through his foreign minister, Mr. Gromyko, as well as through statements that he himself has made on his recent trip to Albania and otherwise, has made it clear that German unification, something to which he paid lip service at the first Geneva summit meeting, has made it clear that this is not an objective which he is going to support, at least in the immediate future. Why he takes this position, of course, only he can say. But there are those who believe that the basic reason for it is that he feels, one, that if Germany is united, it is a greater threat to him and to his power in Europe than it would be divided. And there's a second reason which has become more apparent in just recent weeks, or recent months, I should say. I was talking to Vice Chancellor Earhart when he was in Washington. As you know, he is one of the great experts on economics in the world today, a major leader of Germany. And I asked him about the economic progress that was taking place in East Germany. He pointed out what we all know, that the economic progress of West Germany has been far greater proportionally than that in East Germany. But he agreed that in recent months, in fact over the past year or two, that progress has stepped up considerably, and as a result, East Germany, of all the satellites, is the most valuable satellite to the Soviet Union. It produces more industrially for the Soviet power complex, for example, than Hungary or Poland or any of the other satellites. Having this in mind, combined with the other fact that I've mentioned, we can see why the Soviet Union takes at the present time what would appear to be an intransigent attitude on this issue. But I do not believe that that is any reason for us to change our position, because in the long run, there is no question but that a people like the German people, with their history, their tradition, and their vitality, will be unified. And our position, I think, is a sound one, and one which we should maintain.
Now, Dick Nixon, to shift the pace a little bit and come to another field with which you are familiar, these two questions, which are typical of a number that have been presented. In the first place, what is back of the attack on Secretary Strauss? Is it just politics, or is it that he is not soft on communism? And differently stated, explain the political implications involved in the Senate committee's opposition to Louis Strauss. If it is not political, then please explain what it is.
I would gather from those two questions that both of the questioners had definite views on Mr. Strauss. And I have, too, I might say. There is, of course, some politics involved in the Strauss case. There is some opposition to him based on principle. And there is no question, incidentally, as to Mr. Strauss's strong position on communism. And by the same token, may I say, there is no question as far as those senators who oppose him about their position on communism. They, too, take a strong position. I think I could summarize or try to analyze the position of the opponents to Mr. Strauss in perhaps three categories. One, there are those who disagree with him because of the very strong position he has taken in favor of the private development of atomic power rather than primarily and exclusively turning over that development to the federal government. In my opinion, Mr. Strauss's position is correct on this. The president believes it is correct. While the federal government has to play a part in developing this new source of energy, I think it is important to the future of the kind of an economy that we want in this country that, to the extent possible, private enterprise be allowed to play just as big a part as it can in the development of atomic power. Because as this power becomes more economical and takes the place of other sources of energy, inevitably, who controls this power will control the economy of the country. And we would not want that much power in the hands of the federal government if we turn to the big atomic power federal exponents of this type of plan. This is one major reason for opposition to him. A second major reason is that Mr. Strauss has taken what many consider to be a rigid position on atomic tests, a rigid position on his attitude generally on security, and there are those who believe that because of that rigidity, that he has not cooperated as much with the Congress as he should have in disclosing information which he felt was not properly to be made public or turned over to congressional committees. A third reason, which strangely enough has been implicit in the debate and even runs through the report of the minority on Mr. Strauss, is the one that to the effect that there are members of the Senate who believe that he does not have the personality to be the Secretary of Commerce, that he is arrogant, that he irritates people during his negotiations with the Congress, and that his conduct during the hearings was proof of the fact that he did not have the temperament to be the Secretary of Commerce. Now, what is the answer to all this? I will give you my own. And the reason why I think the president is absolutely sound in insisting on keeping Mr. Strauss's name before the Senate for confirmation, and why those, both Democrat and Republican, who will vote for confirmation are right, and why those who oppose him are wrong. A member of the president's cabinet is selected by him to advise the president. It cannot be expected that a member of the president's cabinet have views that are going to agree with all the members of the Senate who must advise and consent with the president when he does make an appointment to his cabinet. But traditionally, throughout our history, members of the Senate who have disagreed violently with the views of nominees the president has sent down for his cabinet have nevertheless voted for them because they realize that it is the president's prerogative to have people on his cabinet who will represent his views rather than those of his opponents. And so for all those who disagree with Mr. Strauss on the positions he has taken, I believe that certainly their position is certainly not sound. Now, turning to the question of personality, I can say that there were several of the appointments made in the previous administration whose personalities grated on some of the opposing party. I'm sure many Republicans didn't particularly care for Mr. Ickes, but on the other hand, the fact they didn't like his personality didn't mean that they voted against him for confirmation. I think these are the major reasons. It has, of course, developed into a considerable political issue as a result of the violence of the debate, but I would predict at this point that Mr. Strauss will be confirmed, and I predict also that this man, who is controversial, controversial because he does take strong positions and does give leadership, that this man who has rendered very fine service under both Democratic presidents and Republican presidents will, under President Eisenhower, render great service to the nation, and with integrity, intelligence, and dedication as Secretary of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Occasionally we get a question that the chair cannot recognize, and to give you some idea of the scope of the questioning, we will not go beyond reading it, but this is the question. Let's have a few words from Pat. I wouldn't have dared to have read that unless I'd first made it clear to her that she was not going to be called up. Now, here is the next one. Is it true as charged by Senator Stuart Symington that the Eisenhower administration is spending more on farm aid than all previous administrations combined? If so, why?
I noticed with great interest that my former colleague in the Senate and present member of the Senate, Mr. Symington, had spoken to this club just recently, and I had not actually seen in the summary that was sent to me, the bulletin from the Commonwealth Club, his reference to this particular matter. I will only say this in answer to it. As far as the cost of the farm program today, I would not certainly be surprised if the costs annually are greater today than they have been in any previous administration. We now come to why. The reason why is because the agricultural program which this administration is forced to administer was one that we inherited from the previous administration. And had Mr. Symington and some of his colleagues had their way, the costs would be even greater today than they are at the present time. Because what he stands for, and some of his colleagues, is for the high, rigid supports at 90% of parity or above, the same kind of a program which is encouraging the building up of the surpluses which cause the tremendous expenditure of money at the present time. And so all that I can say is this, that as far as the administration's farm program is concerned, we cannot honestly say that we do have a program today that is the Eisenhower administration's program because of the refusal of the Congress, under its Democratic leadership, to give the administration the kind of a farm program that it has asked for and the kind of power that is needed to dig into these huge surpluses. Until we face up to this problem, honestly and directly, we are going to continue to pile up the surpluses, and as we pile up the surpluses, the costs are going to go up. But I would only suggest that I have yet to see on the part of any of our Democratic friends who have been critical of the President's program any proposals that they have made that would do anything else than to create greater surpluses and higher costs than our program today creates.
Now, Mr. Vice President, two questions relating to one of your own addresses that has challenged the thoughts of many Americans. First, in your speech last April concerning the World Court, you stressed the need for moving in the direction of world law. Can the United Nations be effective in enforcing world law without making some fundamental changes in the present charter? And secondly, you have recently suggested that the rule of law should prevail throughout the world. How much American sovereignty should be yielded to an international court, in your opinion, to accomplish this goal? These two questions, of course,
touch upon very fundamental issues which cannot be discussed adequately in the relatively brief time we can allow in a question period. I think perhaps my own views can best be expressed in summary by pointing out first what I have advocated and second what I believe should be the general course of events in the future insofar as the trend toward world law as a substitute for rule of force are concerned. In the first place, what I have suggested is this, that in treaties in which the United States enters in the future, that we should consider including in those treaties a clause to the effect that where any disagreement arose between the parties to the treaties as to the meaning of the treaties, that that disagreement would be submitted to the International Court of Justice at The Hague, which is, as you know, is a United Nations instrument, and which, as you know, has judges representing all the nations of the world, including two judges at the present time from the communist bloc. Now, there are those who suggest that this proposal is unrealistic because the communists will not accept it. This does not mean that it should not be made, it seems to me. It only means that as far as we are concerned, we in the United States, who believe in the rule of law, in the relations between our own citizens, we who take an advanced position on this great issue, that we must take the initiative and the leadership if any progress is going to be made toward its realization. Now, there are those who are concerned whenever it is suggested that any issues between nations be submitted to an international court, that the United States, by that very act, some way infringes upon and weakens its own sovereignty. And my answer is that as far as this proposal is concerned, that the proposal itself is the best reply, because in each individual treaty to which we agree, we make the decision when we make the treaty as to whether this would be a proper case in which we think the basic issue of what the treaty means, interpretation, could be and should be submitted to an international body. And may I say also in that connection that when you examine disputes between nations, you will find that more often than not, they arise out of disagreement as to what an agreement means. For example, in the last Geneva conference, the one to which I referred, the last summit conference, everybody has said after the conference, long after it, that it was a failure. But in terms of the communique that was issued after the conference, or in terms of the agreement which was described in that communique, it was a success. Because in that conference, the Soviet Union, together with the United States and others represented there, agreed that they would work toward unification of Germany, free elections, the other great objectives which are presently in controversy between us. But the difficulty arose at a later time when an attempt was made to implement that agreement, because the agreement meant one thing to the Soviet Union, it meant something else to us. And so this suggestion was made with the thought in mind that in the future we could well obviate this one area of possible disagreements which might otherwise result in settlement by force by submitting them to a court for settlement. Now, looking to the future, I can say that what we must realize is that it is a long, hard road on which we are embarking as we move toward substitution of the rule of force for the rule of law, the rule of law for the rule of force. And I know that there are many people in this country, and for that matter in other countries, who take a very dim view of any moves in that direction. Any moves in that direction, even the modest one that I have suggested, because of this basic concern that we some way we'll be giving up our sovereignty. And my answer is this. There was a time when we could run the risk of allowing all the disagreements that we have with other nations to be settled, if necessary, by resort to force. But that time has passed. It has passed because with the development of not only the transportation, the means of delivery, which I have described in a little earlier this evening, but also because of the development of weapons, the time has passed when the United States or any other nation can refuse to explore every possible means of substituting methods by which our disputes can be settled peacefully through law rather than by force. I do not suggest that it will come overnight. I do not suggest that tomorrow, next year, 5 years from now, there will be a change in the United Nations and its structure which will bring it about. But I do say, as the President said in his State of the Union message, that the United States must consistently take the initiative in exploring and advocating ways and means in which our International Court of Justice can settle more of the disputes between us, and ways and means in which any potential conflicts will be settled not on a battlefield, but at the conference table, or better still, where possible, by a court of law.
Two questions now on generally related subjects. I assume this one is addressed to you in your capacity as Vice President. Is there anything to be gained by going into any kind of conference with the Russians? This is probably addressed to Dick Nixon personally. What do you hope to accomplish by your trip to Russia this summer?
The question as to whether there's anything to be gained by going to any conference with the Russians is one that is frankly asked with a great deal of justification. And having just spoken to the President about the recent developments at the Foreign Ministers' Conference in Geneva this morning, I can say that certainly those developments do not offer too much encouragement for any hope that a conference, either at the foreign minister level or at the summit level, would reduce areas of disagreement between the free world and the communist world. On the other hand, I get back to the proposition that I discussed at greater length in the preceding question. We go to a foreign minister's conference, and provided the foreign minister's conference promises some opportunity for success in a summit conference, we will go there, as the President has indicated, because the alternative to sitting down and talking with the Russians in this long, tedious fashion, the alternative is one that is unacceptable. If we don't talk, inevitably we draw apart, and possibly we might end up by fighting. Now, I think it's generally agreed among most observers that Mr. Khrushchev does not want war today, and certainly nobody in the free world wants it. But when you have tensions between nations, war can come even when all parties do not want it. It can come by miscalculation. And consequently, as long as this situation exists as it does, it means that we must accept those opportunities to attend conferences under the right circumstances. Now, having said that, may I just add this last thought. Under no circumstances should the United States go to a summit conference, the President of the United States, with Mr. Khrushchev, if the Foreign Ministers' Conference fails to meet the conditions which we very properly have laid down, the condition that it must make enough progress in delineating the issues and in resolving areas of conflict to indicate that a summit conference would be worthwhile. In other words, the President of the United States can't be blackmailed in going to a summit conference, he can't be driven to a summit conference, and he isn't going to go to a summit conference simply for the purpose of accepting there the dictation that Mr. Khrushchev, through Gromyko, is attempting to give Mr. Herter at the Foreign Ministers Conference. Now, as far as my trip this summer is concerned, I should point out that as Vice President on all these trips, I go not with the power or with the responsibility for negotiating treaties or agreements, but I do have, and always have had and will have on this occasion, opportunities to meet with Russian leaders and possibly with Mr. Khrushchev, and in these meetings to discuss with them some of the differences that exist between the United States and the Soviet Union. What purpose does this serve? I would say that one of the major purposes it serves is to reduce the lack of understanding which exists among most of the Soviet leaders with regard to the United States and with regard to the free world generally. I found, for example, when Mr. Mikoyan was here in my two conversations with him, first that he greatly underestimated the economic strength of the United States, and he was visibly impressed by what he saw in his trip around this country with regard to the strength of our economy. Second, he thought that the people of the United States were divided on partisan lines and that the president had strong opposition in the Congress against the strong position that he and Secretary Dulles had taken vis-a-vis the Soviet world. And he was wrong on that, as we pointed out. And third, he had certainly definite misapprehensions as to the unity of the United States and our other major allies, France, Germany, the United Kingdom. His visit served to reduce those miscalculations. And any conversations that a leader of the Western world has with Mr. Khrushchev or any other responsible leader of the Soviet Union serves a useful purpose insofar as it may reduce his miscalculation as to our strength, our determination to resist the probing actions that they may launch. The other purpose that such a trip serves is quite obvious. We should have no illusions that by my wife and I going to the Soviet Union, speaking on Soviet television as we will and on radio, visiting their universities, their factories, their farms, meeting perhaps great numbers of the Soviet people, we have no illusions that by this act, these actions, that we are going to win the Soviet people away from communism. But by these actions and by this type of exchange, we do accomplish something which I think is important, and that is to give the lie to the image that is painted of the United States and of the leaders of the United States in the Soviet Union. And that image is one of leaders who are bent on launching atomic war and devastation in the Soviet cities, on leaders who do not have any interest in any other people except ourselves, and who certainly would not be the kind of people that they feel they could get along with in peace and friendship. By going, by their seeing us, by talking to them, certainly we can reduce that miscalculation to an extent among a considerable number of the Soviet people. And finally, in that connection, I will add this one thing. I think it is in the national interests of the United States to extend as much as we possibly can exchange of all types with the Soviet Union. And I mean by that the more that we can bring not only men like Mr. Mikoyan and their top leaders like Mr. Kozlov, who will open their fair in Moscow, in New York, which is the counterpart of the exhibition which we will open in July in Moscow, but people further down in the echelon of Soviet society, bring them here. Bring them again, not with any thought in mind that as they come here, they will immediately deviate and possibly turn against communism, but as they come here, they see the United States as it really is. They see our people as they are, And when they go back, the inevitable leavening effect takes place, which over the long haul is the only answer to the great problem of reducing world tensions to which we have referred earlier.
Now, Vice President Nixon, a question which I'm sure the one who propounds it presents in view of your responsibility among your many as presiding officer of the United States Senate. This is the question. Will the United States Senate eliminate filibusters? If so, when and how?
Very simple answer to that, no.
Three questions now that raise a question which many people, or an issue which many people in this state and throughout the nation are troubled about. Some of them indicate, as you've stated, a point of view. These are the three questions. How far should we go in controlling unions? Is the Kennedy-Ives bill just another bargaining lever for employers? Secondly, what do you think are the chances of effective labor legislation being passed by this Congress? And thirdly, how do you assess the chances of getting any better or getting any labor reform measures passed during this present session?
Incidentally, I might say that referring to the Kennedy-Ives bill, I am reminded of the fact that on the trip out on the jet airliner, sitting immediately in front of me was Ambassador Kennedy, the father of the author of the Kennedy-Ives bill. I met him for the first time and had a very interesting conversation with him in which politics was not excluded, incidentally. Now, turning to labor legislation generally and to the Kennedy-Ives bill specifically. First, as to the bill, and second, as to its prospects. The Kennedy-Ives bill, and actually the term in this session is the Kennedy-Irvin bill, is one which, as you know, was considered by the Senate, passed with an amendment, and is now before the House in its Education and Labor Committee. The bill, as passed by the Senate, is considerably stronger than the bill which was submitted to the Senate by Senator Kennedy and Senator Irvin from the Senate Labor Committee. It is still, however, in my opinion, too weak. Too weak to deal with the excesses that have been exposed by the McClellan Committee on which Mr. Kennedy serves. Now, let me indicate in what respects, or at least two respects, that I think the bill is weak. First, what does it do? On the plus side, the bill is aimed at dealing with some of the abuses with regard to the internal affairs of unions, which were brought out during the hearings. And it provides, for example, devices by which union labor members can be assured of participation in elections where they select their officers at regular intervals. It provides some guarantees with regard to how the union dues that they pay into the Treasury will be expended in their interests. It provides also for other controls on internal union operations, which I think generally are aimed at protecting union members. Beyond that, where it is weak is in dealing with those activities of unions which affect not the union members, but affect the general public, and also which affect employers. And I refer to the provisions with regard to the secondary boycott of the Taft-Hartley Act and the provisions with regard to organizational picketing. There is needed and I think the hearings of the McClellan Committee clearly brought this out, amendments to the present law which will strengthen the ban on secondary boycotts or the restrictions on secondary boycotts, and which will be more effective in outlawing so-called blackmail or organizational picketing, where pickets are thrown around the plant not for purposes of an economic strike, but for purposes simply of compelling an employer to recognize a union when the employees within the plant, by an election or otherwise, have indicated they do not want a union. Generally, it is agreed that these two areas should be dealt with by legislation. They are not dealt with in this particular bill. And I think the bill should certainly be strengthened in those two respects. Now, what prospects are there for the bill in its present form, which, as I indicated, I believe is too weak for the reasons that I mentioned, or in any form to get through? I would say that as far as this session of Congress is concerned, the prospects for the passage of any labor legislation are rather dim. I would say that in the next session, the session starting in January, that there would be some prospect for some labor legislation possibly to come out of the House, provided Speaker Rayburn and the Democratic leadership in the House can agree on what the legislation should be. They have the votes, an overwhelming majority in the House, to pass some labor legislation, but they have very violent disagreement among their own members as to what it ought to be. And at the present time, if I were to make a prediction, I would say very little possibility then of any legislation in this session of the Congress, unless a change of signals is given pretty soon by Mr. Rayburn. And second, some possibility for legislation in the next session. But as far as the type of legislation is concerned, I do not believe that the bill will be strengthened, as it should be strengthened, to deal with the kind of abuses to which I refer. May I say finally in this connection that our purpose in labor legislation should be simply, very simply, to make all unions follow the good practices that many unions follow today. It should not be directed at weakening unions, at destroying them, but it should certainly be directed at dealing with some of the patent abuses, abuses which have worked to the detriment of union members, certainly to the detriment, I imagine, of some employers, but more important than that, to the detriment of the general public. And I would say that if labor legislation, a bill stronger than the present Kennedy-Irvin bill, is not passed, either in this session or the next session of Congress, it will be a major issue in the campaign of 1960, and should be, in my opinion.
Now, Vice President Nixon, I have in mind the admonition that this is not a political meeting, but the cards indicate that the customers want politics. So we're going to wrap four up in one, and this will be the political question of the evening. You may pick or choose as you please. In the first place, do you agree with Walter Reuther, who spoke before the club last Friday, when he said that all the conservatives should be placed in one party and all of the liberals in another?
I'll take that one.
Take that one first? Right.
Go ahead.
May I say that I agree with Mr. Reuther on some things, but I disagree with him on many more things, and on this I very emphatically disagree with him. I think it would be a great tragedy in the United States if we had our two major political parties divide on what we would call a conservative liberal line. I know the suggestion has often been made that what ought to be done is that the Republican Party, for example, should make common cause with the more conservative Democrats of the South and form a new party, which would be called the Conservative Party, and that then all of those who support what Mr. Reuther would call the labor point of view would be in another party. Now, why don't I think this would be a good thing? Because I think one of the attributes of our political system has been that we have avoided, generally, violent swings in administrations from one extreme to another. And the reason we have avoided that is that in both parties there has been room for a broad spectrum of opinion. Now, it is true that the Republican Party generally, as far as its economic philosophy is concerned, is more conservative than the Democratic Party today. The center of ideology in the Republican Party is further to the right. The center of ideology of the Democratic Party is further to the left. But in the Democratic Party, there are some who are more conservative than men like Mr. Ruther, who is one of the leading figures in the Democratic Party. And in the Republican Party, there are some people who are more liberal, for example, than Senator Goldwater, who is considered to be one of the more conservative Republicans. I think this is good. I think it is good because by having this room in both parties for a broad spectrum of views, it means that when your administrations come to power, they then will represent the whole people rather than just one segment of the people. And when the time comes in this country when we have our elections between a Labor Party and an employers' party, employers, farmers, and whatever other groups that would not be classified with the Labor Party, I would say that we would have very violent contests in elections, and after the elections, we would have extreme swings in legislative approaches that would not be in the best interest of the country. So I would say that Mr. Ruther, in this case, I think is wrong, and I would hope that this view would not be one that would be adopted by his party. I am sure it is not one that will be adopted by ours. Here
are the other three questions which I was going to present to you on this subject. What political party will save America and why? Do you plan to campaign in Oregon next spring, inasmuch as your name will be on the presidential preference ballot under a new Oregon law, whether you like it or not? And lastly, who do you think will be the two leading contenders for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, and who do you think will be the winner?
Well, I really, taking the last two questions first, as far as Oregon is concerned, my answer here is the one I gave in New York a little earlier, where some interest was also expressed in politics when I met with Governor Rockefeller. I can only say that this is too early to make decisions with regard to what should be done in the campaign of 1960. And as far as campaigning in Oregon is concerned, I would say that I have made no decision and would not, of course, be in a position, therefore, to answer this question, whether the questioner likes it or not. Now, the second point is, with regard to the two leading candidates for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. Now, I know it's a very very common practice these days for the representatives of one party to name their favorite candidates in the other party. Usually the drill goes something like this. We say this fellow or that fellow will be easier or harder to beat, and then hope that the voters do exactly the opposite. Now, this is a very sophisticated and intelligent audience. I don't need to tell you that. You're aware of it. And knowing that, I realize that any answer I would give to this question would be one which you would realize it would be a prejudiced one. And so, consequently, I would not want to hurt the chances of any of my Democratic friends by naming them as a favorite. I would not want to help them by saying that they might lose. I can only say that having talked to to Jack Kennedy's father, Ambassador Kennedy, on the plane today, that and having mentioned his name, that he at the present time, from all the polls, is the front-running candidate on the Democratic ticket. I think that those who are writing him off because of his religion and his youth may have to take a rereading if he continues to show the popular support that he has indicated to date. In addition to that, and I will not limit it to just two, Mr. Symington, whom you heard last week, along with Mr. Stevenson, the two of them are probably the major dark horses. Dark horses because they seem to fit the bill for a compromise candidate better than most of the rest. Mr. Stevenson has proved that he could do that twice by being nominated twice, and Mr. Symington has avoided making anybody mad at him up to this point, in the Democratic Party at least, and so consequently he has, I would say, a reasonable chance on the dark horse side. The other candidates that should be mentioned, Mr. Humphrey, of course, has rather strong support from what would be termed the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Senator Johnson has begun to move, and despite the fact he comes from Texas, I think could be a strong candidate by the time nomination comes around, assuming that the front runners stumble. Now, having said all these things, I can only say this, that I believe that all of these men on the Democratic side are men of ability. All of them would be good candidates, but I think the Republican candidate for the president, whoever he is, will beat him in 1960. That's my answer to the question.
Dick Nixon, you have been most generous, not only with your time, but with what energy and voice is left in you after this trying day. I assure you that it was not with any malice that I held up the political question until just before I reminded the audience that upon the adjournment of this part of the meeting, there will be a brief reception in the adjoining Rose Room. On behalf of all of the members of the Commonwealth Club of California, those who are here tonight with their guests, and the many who will read about this meeting in our club transactions, we thank you for coming to San Francisco and being our guest. As a fellow member of this club, we are confident you will be back again. And regardless of party, regardless of our personal point of view, we extend to you, sir, our very best wishes in whatever may be your undertakings, both in this year and in the future. Thank you very much.